That's where we are today. We're still on this trek, this journey to Golgotha, as we examine why it was the Jewish people executed Jesus of Nazareth. Of all the factors contributing to the execution of Jesus, the most significant of them all was his claiming to be the Son of God, his claiming to be the Messiah. His teachings had awed the common people and had silenced his critics. His miracles had stunned the nation, but his miracles had become almost commonplace. There were so many of them. In fact, it was that which was out of the ordinary that he could not do any miracles. He went home once to Nazareth, and the record says that he couldn't do much there, couldn't perform many miracles there because of their unbelief. But it's recorded as though it were the exception. His miracles had almost become commonplace in a nation that was stunned by them at first. But neither his miracles nor his teachings, neither of them was used against him in his trial. Neither of them was called for as evidence that this man was doing something he shouldn't have been doing. It was his consistent, incessant claim to be of God, to be the Son of God, to be one with God, to have God in him and him to be in God, to have God as his Father, to have all of these claims that he made. This was what caused the Jewish leaders, the Jewish high court, the Jewish Sanhedrin, to sentence him to death for blasphemy. I want us to ask a question. We're going to be studying today and two more Sundays about him and his claims to be the Son of God. What I'd like to do this morning with you is ask the question, was there just cause for their sentencing him? Was there just cause? Now, I'm not questioning his credentials here. I'm not questioning what we believe, that he was the Christ. What I'm asking, and I want us to consider, is was there ample forewarning for the Jewish people? Did the Jewish nation have ample advance notice that the man was who he claimed to be? Or was it something that was sprung on them all of a sudden and they weren't prepared for it? The question that I want us to address is simply that. Was the Jewish nation adequately informed in advance? And the answer that comes back is a resounding yes. They were adequately informed. That's not my assessment as a non-Jew. That's the assessment of a man who was Jewish to the core. He was a Pharisee of Pharisees. He was born of the tribe of Benjamin. And the man in the Roman correspondence in the 10th chapter answers this question with a resounding yes. Yes, they knew. In the 11th or 10th chapter in verse 16, and we'll step outside the gospel records into this. 25 years later, Paul makes this statement. But not all the Israelites accepted the good news. For Isaiah said, Lord, who has believed our message? Consequently, when faith comes from hearing the message, and the message is heard through the word of Christ. But I ask, and here's the question, did they not hear? And Paul then answers, of course they did. Their voice has gone out into the earth, all of the earth, their words to the end of the world. Again I ask, did Israel not understand? And the question is asked and implied, yes, of course they understood. First Moses said, I will make you envious by those who are not a nation. I'll make you angry by a nation that has no understanding. And Isaiah boldly says, I was found by those who didn't seek me. I revealed myself to those who did not ask for me. But concerning Israel, he says, all day long I have held out my hands to a disobedient and obstinate people. Yes, they had adequate forewarning. They had been forewarned amply by the prophets of old. You may want to turn with me, or you may want, I didn't bring my Old Testament text, I just printed it out from Isaiah the 7th chapter, verse 14. Listen to one of these prophets. Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. Again, in Isaiah the 9th chapter, verses 6 and 7, for to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. Good night. That's so specific. To us a child is born. He'll be born of a virgin. He'll be called Emmanuel. He'll be called Almighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, Mighty a Counselor. All of these things. Then in Micah 5, 1 and 2. Marshal your troops, O city of troops, for a siege is laid against us. They'll strike Israel's ruler on the cheek with a rod. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you were small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. Yes, they were adequately informed. Do you have the handout? In your handout, listen to this. It's from Daniel, the 9th chapter, 24 through 27. This is one of those time prophecies. Ezekiel gives some of them. Daniel is the most specific, I think. 70 sevens are decreed for your people and your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the Most Holy One. Know and understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the Anointed One, the ruler, comes, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. After the 62 sevens, the Anointed One will be cut off and will have nothing. The people of the ruler will come, who will come and destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and desolations have been decreed. He will confirm a covenant with many for 1 7-year period. In the middle of the seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. And on a wing of the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. Isn't that an unusual statement? Daniel 9, 24 to 27. The existence of these prophecies was well known. This was not hidden. As Paul told Agrippa, these things weren't done in a corner. This was not something that just was done without any notice being drawn to it. These were statements that were made, and you'll have to understand that Daniel's prophecy was made about 5 centuries, 500 years before these astonishing claims were fulfilled. But these predictions were common knowledge. Micah 5:2 was common knowledge. The scholars knew about where the Messiah was to be born. When the Magi came from the east, they came and said, where is the king of the Jews to be born? We've seen his star in the east, and we've come to worship him. And Herod gathered together all the wise men in Jerusalem, and they came back and said to him, well, he's to be born in Bethlehem. And then he quotes that Micah 5:2. It was common knowledge. At least the scholars knew about it. Herod didn't. Herod was an Idumean. He was about as ignorant of the scriptures as you could be. But nevertheless, the scholars knew about it. And then this Daniel prophecy, Daniel 9, 24 through 27, it was well known. It was a hot topic. It was a hot topic at the time that Jesus lived. In fact, in the few years prior to Jesus life and the few years after his life, this prophecy provided the background out of which arose a whole slew of men who claimed to be messiahs. Now they came at various times. Would you like to guess how many of these so-called messiahs came in this period of time? Oh, about 50 or so years before Jesus was born and about 50 years after, in a window of about 100 years. Would you like to guess how many false messiahs there were? Or how many, we won't call them false, how many other messiahs rose up to say they were the Christ? 64. 64 other men than Jesus from Nazareth during that period of time. And it was just a window of time, and we'll notice in a moment why. Daniel's prophecy there contains the statement from the issuing of the decree, that's verse 25, to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. You see, this was stated after Jerusalem had been destroyed by the Babylonians. They were now in Babylonian captivity. Daniel now makes this prophecy because one of the Persian kings, the Medo-Persian Empire, one of the Persian kings had made a decree that Jerusalem was going to be restored. It was going to be rebuilt, and the temple would be restored, and the people would be restored into that city, and they were going to spend 70 years in Babylonian, or that captivity in Babylon, from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the Anointed One. Years ago, when we were living in New Zealand, I was studying that passage, and I just thought, I wonder what that word Anointed One means. I wonder what it comes from. I thought I knew, but I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if you go back, and I went back into the Septuagint, into the Greek text, and I found that passage in Daniel, the 9th chapter. I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if that word there is the word Christos, Ho Christos? And I wasn't surprised, and yet it startled me. Because when I read it in the original language, this is what it says. Know this and understand it. From the issuing of the decree to restore and build Jerusalem until the Christ comes. There will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. The city will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble, after the 62 sevens, the Anointed One, and there that word was again, it just jumped out at me. The Christ will be cut off, and that simply means he'll be crucified. And we'll have nothing. And then the people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The people of the ruler there, evidently referring to the Roman Empire, and the people of the ruler led by Titus, who was the son of the emperor, adopted son of the emperor. And so he came with his forces and destroyed the city of Jerusalem. And when the end will come like a flood, war will continue until the end. Desolations have been decreed. He will confirm a covenant with many for one, and then he goes ahead and talks about it. But in that period of time, and there was a window of about 80 to 100 years, and I can't be specific about this, but I want to leave a general principle. The reason why you can't be specific is because there was more than one decree. Now, Daniel had simply said from the time that it is decreed that the city is going to be rebuilt until the coming of the Christ, and the word seven here, the 7 sevens and the 62 sevens, the 77s, that's agreed by all scholars of the Scriptures that it means 70 periods of 7 years. 77s. 77 years. 70 times 7, which would be how many? 490 years. But then he broke it down into three different parts. 62 sevens and 7 sevens and then another 7 that would be cut off in the middle. Well, the 69 sevens would be 483 years. But now look at, if you'll notice, I put on your paper here. It's difficult to pinpoint when these periods of years began because there was more than one edict. And thus it's difficult to calculate the fulfillment. Those edicts are as follows. The edict of Cyrus II, 538 B.C., and check 2 Chronicles 36 and Ezra 1. And then the decree of Darius to honor the initial edict by Cyrus. That took place in 521 or 520. Check Ezra chapter 6 on that. The temple was restored in 515 B.C. But then there was a third decree issued by Artaxerxes. And he was the successor of Xerxes. And the reason why Xerxes means anything to us is he was the husband of Esther. He was the one that chose Esther over the over his former wife, and Esther, the Jewish princess, became the queen of his kingdom. But anyway, there was this third decree issued by Artaxerxes, who was Xerxes' successor, which accompanied Ezra in 457 B.C. on his return to Judah. And this decree allowed for the refurbishing of the temple and the subsidizing of offerings. Now, the reason why I mentioned those things, and I know it gets complex, and that you'll have to bear with me when I speak on things like this. I'm not very clear. That's why I wanted you to have something in your hand so you could take it home and in your hot little hand and have it with you. But think for a moment, 483 years from the first one of these edicts in 538 B.C. 483 years from that time would put you about, well, let's see, 483 from 538. What would that do? I had it down on another piece of paper. How much? 50, it would put you at 55 B.C. But 483 years tacked on to 457 B.C., if you go 483 years beyond that, then you've got yourself passing point zero at B.C. zero, or the zero, and you go across into A.D., guess what year you come across into? You come across into what? Into A.D. 26. Do you know who started his personal ministry in the year A.D. 26? Jesus of Nazareth. But now the point I'm making is simply that. In between 55 B.C. and A.D. 26, there's a period of about 80 or so years in there where it was possible, because these are not exact enough that you can just nail down, but in between there, and you'll watch, if you will, those years before Christ and those years after Christ, they presented this in this flux or this influx of all these men claiming to be Messiah. Now, you know two of them. If you look at Acts, the fifth chapter, I think it's verses 26 and 27 in Acts, the fifth chapter, two of them are named there. Who were they? They rhyme. It sounds like they're twins, but they're not. Judas and Theudas. Judas and Theudas. Judas, incidentally, was the grandson, I think, of a man by the name of Zechariah, who held up in a little mountain stronghold on the west coast of the Sea of Galilee. We went up into his stronghold. He did that in about 100 B.C. And then later on, Menahem and others of his descendants were those involved in the Masada. So you've got one whole family here, all of this taking place, and all of these men claiming to be Messiah. But Jesus of Nazareth was one of those 65 men claiming to be Messiah. But it's interesting that his ministry began 483 years after the third of these edicts. Interesting. You know, he's the only man of all the 65 Messiahs. He is the one that stands out as different from all the rest. All other 64 of them were rabid nationalists. All other 64 were insurrectionists. All the other 64 were bloodthirsty nationalists to the point of being extremists. They were absolutely intolerant with the power of Rome over them. And then here comes this man who was a man of peace, totally different from the others. Does it surprise you that he is the only man that his own people killed? It's no surprise, is it, that the other 64 were murdered by Rome? Because they were opposing Rome. Jesus came, he didn't oppose Rome. Jesus was the only one of the 65 that his own people killed. Why? Because he came claiming nothing other than what was prophesied that he would be. Nothing other than what was prophesied. He'd be born in Bethlehem. He'd be born of a virgin. He would be born to be the ruler. He would be the one that would rule on David's throne. And all of these prophecies about him, and there are about 300 prophetic statements that have to do with the particulars and the specifics of the life of this man. And he fulfills all of them. In fact, the last Sunday of this month,
As has already been mentioned this morning, a young Jewish Christian from Little Rock, Arkansas, is going to come and be with us. And it was through this means that he found his faith in Jesus Christ. He took those Old Testament prophecies and sweated over them, and he worked over them, and he labored over them, and he groaned, and he wrestled with them. But he took these Old Testament prophecies and came to grips with them face to face and dealt with them as accurately and as honestly as he could. And when the thing was over and he had examined them, he came to the conclusion that Jesus of Nazareth, that he really was the Jewish Messiah. And this young man believed it so strongly that he was willing to be cut off from his people and to be considered as dead because he had turned and accepted Jesus as the Christ. Yes, there was adequate forewarning. The idea of the appearance of the Messiah was not foreign to those people, and it should not have offended them. They should not have rejected his claims, but they were offended. They did object to them. They did renounce him from beginning to end. It was an offense to them. And I mentioned a few moments ago, the announcement of the arrival of the king of the Jews caused such a paranoid panic in Herod that he slaughtered the little babies, all the baby boys, 2 years old and younger, in the city of Bethlehem. He slaughtered them. Matthew, the second chapter, records it. 12 years later, after the slaughter, 12 years later, a young lad from Nazareth startled the Jewish leaders by standing there in the temple area and answering them with such wisdom and such sharpness and asking them such insightful questions that it startled the Jewish leaders, and it caused his mother to be dumbfounded as he made this statement when she spanked him almost by saying, "Why have you done this to your father and me? We've been looking for you for days. Why have you done this?" And this little innocent fellow said, why were you looking for me? Did you not know I had to be in my father's house?" And that was the first words out of his mouth that we have. And we see him being launched on this long and lonely trek toward Golgotha as he was confronted, and as he confronted the unyielding disbelief of just about everybody that he was in association with. His mother pondered these things in her heart, but his younger brothers didn't. They rejected him. About 18 years of obscurity. Don't hear a word about him. No one in history knows anything about the year. 18 long years. He apprenticed as a carpenter. His father died some years after this event here in Jerusalem when he was 12. His father died some years later. His mother still lived. Of course, was there when he was executed. But he became a carpenter. Remained a carpenter for about 18 years. Supported his family. And then one day, it was time. He laid down his tools, walked out of his shop, shut the door, and began this great ministry of his of doing good things and healing people and teaching and claiming to be this Messiah. And it lasted just about a half of a seven, about 3.5 years. Finally, at the end of that, it's about 3.5 years into his ministry, he was arrested by the Jewish authorities. He was tried on the charge of blasphemy and was brought up before the Roman rulers for condemnation. While he was standing before the Jewish court, the high priest Caiaphas, in a daring but illegal move, it was illegal to try a man for a capital punishment at night. It was against the Jewish law. It was against the law. And there's a list of about, I don't know how many, 16 or 20 things that the Jewish leaders went in direct opposition to the law. It was illegal from beginning to end. It was a kangaroo court. But in frustration, after Jesus would not respond to these petty accusations that had been brought up by these hired people, the Jewish leaders hired false witnesses to testify against Jesus, and he would not stoop to even answer their questions. The old high priest, Caiaphas, became so frustrated. He said, "I adjure you, in the name of God Almighty, are you the Christ, the Son of God?" And every eye in the whole Sanhedrin must have focused upon him. And he turned to the man and he said, "You are right. It is as you say. And he said, furthermore, I'll tell you that you will not see me henceforth until you see me coming on the clouds of the right hand of the Almighty. He said, you'll see me on his right hand. And the old, he took his garment, which was a typical gesture of people in that culture. And he took his robe and he ripped it. And he said, what further need do we have of witnesses? You've heard it with your own ears. What is your judgment? What's your sentence? Soberly they said, he is worthy of death. I want to read it for you. Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you're the Christ, the Son of God. Yes, it is as you say, Jesus replied. But I say to all of you, in the future, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, he has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you've heard the blasphemy. What do you think? And they nodded their heads. He's worthy of death. Then they spit in his face. And they struck him with their clenched fist. There's a specific word that means the clenched fist. There's the Greek word for spit. And it simply is like this. That's the way you would pronounce it or come near to pronouncing the Greek word for spit. Is. They spit in his face. And then the word, they hit him with their clenched fist. There were those that just flailed him with their fist clenched. And then there's another word here. And others struck him. Others slapped him. And the word there is to slap with your open hand. So there were those that they spit in his face. They hit him with clenched fist. And others just came up and slapped him with their open hand. And said, prophesy to us, you Christ. Who hit you? Yes, the brutality of man is absolutely unbelievable. Were you there when they crucified our Lord?